Welcome to Local Exposure, a podcast about music and the greater Cincinnati scene. I'm Jim Nolan. Thanks for listening. All families have history, but not many have a story as rich and evocative as that of local musician Napoleon Maddox. The show, Twice the First Time, which Maddox put together with French DJ and producer Sorg, in collaboration with My Cincinnati, Chase Public, and Elements, tells the tale of Maddox's ancestors, Millie Christine McCoy, conjoined twins who were born in the town of Whiteville, North Carolina, in the year 1851. Through music, performance, and visuals, their life story is told of how they were born into slavery, kidnapped, taken to England, and exhibited in circuses and sideshows. Twice the First Time was originally commissioned by the Contemporary Art Center in 2017, and since then, Napoleon and Sorg have taken the show across Europe. Now, they return to Cincinnati on Friday, May 17th, to bring their performance to the Woodward Theater. I had the great pleasure to sit down with Napoleon Maddox and Sorg to talk about the story of Millie Christine and the creation of Twice the First Time.
In a neighborhood near you. Mama's in the mirror painting a smile on.
Napoleon Maddox, Sorg, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Tell me the story of Millie Christine.
Well, they were the aunts of my grandmother, so they were my great grand aunts, and they were born in 1851 in a town called Whiteville, North Carolina. And when they were born, their family were enslaved. Their mother and their father were enslaved. And so the people that owned them, like the first person that actually owned them was a farmer who saw that he had the opportunity to benefit from the fact that they were different, that they were conjoined twins, or as at the time they called them Siamese twins. But he wasn't a businessman. And so he winded up doing something like leasing them out. And in the process of them being exhibited, they were stolen in North Carolina during the time that they were being exhibited. They weren't even 2 years old yet. And so in that whole process, that transaction, the guy that was the lessee had to pay in full the cost of the value, you know, like if you're leasing a car, that sounds really crass to say it this way. But
no,
because
they were considered property.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So yeah. If you're leasing a car and you total that car, or if it gets stolen, you're on the hook for the whole price, you know. So that person had to then pay the full price. And the investor that he got to pay the full price became the owner. So the investor, who was another landowner, another property owner in the South, he then hired a private investigator to find out where they were. And by the time he found out where they were, they had been stolen from the first guy who swindled, and the second con person had taken them to England. And they were probably, by this time, they were about to turn 3 years old. The people who had the money said, well, okay, the best thing is to go with the mother of these children to England, where slavery is no longer happening, and retrieve them, because that was the only way to get them back to the United States. And so that's a benefit to the family, but also a benefit to the people who own them. So they were reunited with the mother and brought back to the United States, where they grew up performing in the circus for the profit of the people that own them.
And what a bittersweet reunion.
Yeah, exactly. And then by the time the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation occurred, they were already quite famous, but they were also really intelligent. They learned multiple languages, and they could read or write. In general, that was forbidden for slaves to read and write at the time. But they could read, write poetry, and speak really well, and they would dance and sing.
So what age are they at this point?
By the time the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation occurred, they would have been in their late teens. And so then as performers, they continued to perform and they gained enough wealth and notoriety to buy the place where they had been on the plantation.
And what a twist.
Yeah.
The story you've just told, there's so much to unpack there.
Mm.
You have two young women,
mm-hmm.
conjoined twins.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I don't want to get too crass, but it's amazing that the owner mm-hmm. even allowed them to survive in my mind.
Right, yeah.
Because I would think, you know, again, they're viewed as property. They can't necessarily work. They right. can't necessarily produce like someone who's not part of a conjoined twin. So, you know, where did he even get the idea that this is something that I could capitalize on?
I think the first person that owned them was like, you know, if we were able to go back to that moment, you know, yeah. it probably came down to a conversation of influence, like one person talking to him and saying, oh, you know, well, you know, there's an idea there. I've seen freak shows and I've seen these, and that could have been the shift, like you said, that he's not necessarily, you could have went a different way.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
very, it could have went easily. A very different way, but it could have come down to a simple conversation with somebody that he was able to listen to, somebody who had his ear, that not necessarily was an advocate for human rights, but saw the profit potential.
Sure. And you said the phrase freak show, and I've seen references to them being displayed in what they call circuses, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, it was essentially freak shows. I mean, let's be honest.
And
what was the environment? You said they were like 3 years old at this time. What are they living like? What are the conditions that they're living in?
Well, in the books that I've read, the books talk about the travels that they had and being up and down the Mississippi River. You know, a lot of the travel was either by train or by steamboat. And so one of the books talks about the steamboat that they were on and they're being able to see on the lower decks of the paddle boat, the steamboat going up the Mississippi. They're able to see other livestock and slaves on the same ship. So they lived in the real South, in the real United States of America at that time, or the divided states of America to soon face the Civil War. So it's really interesting. And I think, you know, I'm going to find more and more as I continue to research this entire story. But there's so much that requires research to really figure out, you know, what was under the surface. Where are the other layers to this story? So I did go to Whiteville, North Carolina, shortly after launching this project and doing the first tour in Europe, and then coming back here that summer, we drove down and I met cousins I didn't know, and I met a 90-year-old journalist who had done an expose about them in the 70s. And so he was able to interview people who actually saw them. You know, so at this time, these people are in their twilight years, but they remembered when they were children seeing Lily Christine, and they had a white carriage coming to town. And so it was something like seeing, you know, a white Cadillac or Rolls Royce coming down the road, and you're like, oh, they're coming. So people in their community really celebrated them later in their life and would want to talk to them about their travels. So it's really, I'm still discovering. It's a story that I grew up with. You know, my mother...
I was going to ask you, how did you discover that these individuals were part of your family, part of your heritage?
It was something that I learned probably as early as I learned my ABCs. Hmm. You know, my mother made sure that we saw pictures of them and she really celebrated them. And the complex and emotionally difficult parts of the story I learned as an adult. But as a child, she always celebrated that they were poets and that they were considered like, that they were celebrities, the eighth wonders of the world, and all these different adjectives, colorful, beautiful adjectives that I found to be true. And even now, when you look on the internet, there are not a lot of people that you can search from the 1800s or from even the 1900s. There are not that many photos of certain people. You know, the average person, you won't find photos of that period, but you can find photos of them when they're children. So this is in the 1800s, you know, and all throughout their lives. So that tells me that they were indeed well-known, they were famous and well-regarded.
So what became of them after they purchased the plantation?
They remained a part of their community, and they, although they were traveling around the world, and the Queen of England gave them diamond brooches, and so they were regarded by royalty as someone important, but they continued to come back to North Carolina, and they established a community there called Welsh's Creek. To me, I compare it to something like Lincoln Heights, you know, because it's outside of the city, but it's close enough where it's really a part of the greater Whiteville area, if you can say that, because it's really a small town. Right. Whiteville itself is a village compared to Cincinnati. So there's this other town outside. So they stayed in their community, and they contributed greatly to churches and hospitals, and they were philanthropists. And then the other tragedy is that at some point, there was a fire in their house. There were no fatalities at that moment. They bought this chest. They had a chest full of some valuable items, but their house, a mansion, essentially burned to the ground. Mm-hmm. And while it was burning, they sat outside on this chest, and it started to rain. And because of all of the rain and just sitting out in the cold, one of them contracted, eventually it developed into tuberculosis. And that was eventually why one of them died, and then the other one died 12 hours later. Hmm. And they lived to be 61 years old.
Wow.
So it was quite a storied life. And even that, you know, I met, you know, in talking to my cousin and doing this research, and there's a road with their name in North Carolina. And I was like, well, what happened? And was it because of the Reconstruction, or was it the Klan that came and burned their house? And she said, no, you know, it wasn't that. It was like a careless family member that was like always put things too close to the stove. And so that was another lesson for me, like, wow, you know, it's just another human story, you know.
Welcome back home, Minnie Christine. Welcome back home. Good on the surface, in the hood there's a circus of ladies parade around a cabaret outfit, and my brothers are smoked out doing flips. This ain't no metaphor, it's literal. Illiterate families are no place to go but the big top, and the ghetto ain't no pit stop, it's the home address. We'll clown blast from cannons and get undressed, no redress confronting the drama, paint a smile on a gesture to cover the trauma, and maybe some good come from the hood and pain. Travel the globe and you know the world we entertain, cause the whole world is the ghetto, and the ghetto is a circus, man.
So then let's talk about how you decided, I need to celebrate this story. I need to make this into a musical experience. How did that begin?
Well, I think it had been kind of bubbling up to the surface even before I realized it, because some of the songs that is what had over the years connected to the theme well before we decided to do this show. So we plugged those, like one particular song called Circus is a song that I think we started playing in 2004, 2005, and then released it on an album in 2006. But when we did this, Circus fit right into the theme of the show. I think it really came to the surface when Drew Klein, the curator and director of the Black Box series at the Contemporary Arts Center, he said, well, we're gonna give you the space to do something, and here's time on the calendar, and you do a residency, and here's your budget, all of that. And I thought for a while, and this twice the first time was what developed out of that. But to put my finger on one thing, I couldn't exactly do that. I think it's just a story there waiting to be told.
It's kind
told.
Of the perfect storm of elements came together, and right. This is what I need to do.
Yeah.
So you and Sorg have collaborated several times in the past. How did you meet? Because you are from France. You're from Cincinnati. What's the connection here?
Actually, Napoleon is touring in France for a long time with his project Is What and a lot of other projects in the jazz in France, in festivals. So I knew his name and some people in my city. I come from Besançon, it's the east of France. Some people collaborated with him already in my city. So I knew his name, and I think it was in 2012. I was searching for a rapper to make a, because I'm a beat maker and musician, and I have a solo project named Sorg, doing instrumentals, and I wanted to find an MC from America or England, and so I contacted some rapper, and Napoleon replied directly saying that he was interested. So we started together to make just one track named Wild West in my EP, my second EP. So we released the track in 2013, and then we met in France because he was playing in my town in Besançon with his wife. So we met there, and we exchanged, we spoke, and then it came like that. We said, okay, we can do something together, because it was easy. He was rapping, I was doing beats. We started to play together at the end of 2013, and we really launched the project in 2014. And then, yeah, it just came. We did a lot of shows in France, and we released our first EP in 2014.
Tell me about some of the musicians that you have involved with this project. I know from seeing the videos, which we'll have posted on our website, one person that I immediately recognized was Eddie Kwan.
Yeah, and Eddie Kwan. He's really important to the project because and there's just something really special about Eddie, and he gets the importance of narrative and sharing stories and family. He's close to his family, and he just supports it in so many ways.
He does the link between Iswat and us.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
he does the melodic link.
Yeah, he links the fact that you have this concentrated musical identity of Iswat, and then you have the sound and the sonic texture and the way that Sorg and I work together, and Eddie makes a nice bridge in between to improvise and also to add the strings and to just build a bridge between those two worlds. So yeah, that's definitely musically important. But above all, I really value the way that people feel a thing and the way that people have the sense of why something is important, how and why to tell a story is just as important or even maybe more important than the technique. That's something that, you know, our close friends have said about Sorg, that how can this guy know enough about your history and your story? He didn't grow up with your story, but he makes music that feels like it's supposed to be in this story. So
they said that?
Yeah. Kim said that, in fact.
Even. Okay.
Well, you also have, I know, again, from watching the videos, a tremendous bass player, tremendous drummer. Mm. Who are these people?
Oh, yeah. So the bass player is Brent Olds, and he came here... Wow, probably about 15 years ago, he moved to Cincinnati to play with Iswat, and now he's really a part of the musical community. He was living between Indianapolis and Chicago when he moved here, and he started touring with us. He's been around the country touring with Iswat, and now he's also been around Europe. He also plays in the Clifftones, so shout out to the Clifftones. And the drummer that you see there is Deanna Kennedy, a killer drummer, incredible drummer, grew up here in Cincinnati, and is really a huge talent. You probably also see April Rain, DJ April Rain.
Yes.
Who is a longtime comrade and collaborator with Iswat, and she also is a colleague that works at Elements Hip Hop Youth Center. So we go way back. And on saxophone, there's a documentary film that's shown on French television, that there's a French saxophone player that's in the Iswat family named Eric Sevre. We call him Raggy. And there's a different film with the American saxophone player named Dan Barger. And a lot of people know Dan from playing in all kinds of bands. And if you're a saxophone player, then you know Dan because he probably fixed your saxophone. and he's a really great musician and a composer. He's like a mad scientist of musical theory and anything technical dealing with the instrument and the sound waves.
And the last one is, he's not a musician. He's the, you say a VJ?
A VJ.
Yeah. His name is Iz. He's coming from France in Besançon, in my city. That is originally, he's doing the VJ for Sorg and Napoleon Madoc, the duet in France, because we did a lot of tour, as I was saying, and we were touring with him. So Napoleon called him to do the video on the show of Twice the First Time. So he's the eighth one. Mm-hmm.
When you're performing Twice the First Time, the persona that you have on stage is of Millie Christine's father. Is that correct?
That's correct. Well, it starts off that way. In the original version, I start off as me, and then I have a revelation, and I'm thinking about the past, and then I morph into my great-great-grandfather. I think that's right. Either great-great or great-great-great. One of those, one of my ancestors, and I transform into him. His name was Jacob. And then I'm reflecting on the fact that I'm already trying to figure out how to survive this life that I'm in, and there's a child on the way, and then I discovered that they're conjoined twins, and I want to celebrate, but I'm also like, well, how are they going to make it? And people are coming from everywhere to watch them. And in this story, by the time you realize what story I'm telling, we're in the middle of it, and people are pretty caught up in that. And then I transform into the ringmaster of the circus that they were in.
There's one point in the performance where you actually are wearing shackles mm-hmm. on your wrist.
Yeah.
And it's a very, very powerful image on so many different levels.
Mm.
I hate to over politicize this, but for one, I'm seeing, the obvious imagery of the slave,
mm-hmm.
but then there seems to be another more modern layer on top of that, meaning in connection to the over-incarceration of young black men in our day.
Mm.
Is that conscious?
I think it's subconscious, and it's kind of ever present in telling my story and having so many friends and cousins and then people that I know by association and people that I read about, and just, like you said, the story's on and on. So it's like an underlying narrative almost. Sometimes it's almost like it's always being told, and it has to be, if I'm not going to tell it, it's almost deliberate, like to shut it off, like, okay, now I'm going to tell a different story. But I think one of the powerful things that I'm doing in telling the story from the perspective of their father and also giving them voice, giving Millie Christine voice, I'm also giving voice to a part of the narrative that is undershared, underknown, undertold, is that we have survived as a community and as a people because of the whole family, and that the black man is present. I knew my father from birth until he passed away, and we were always close, and I love him dearly as I love all my family. But I'm grateful to be able to talk about a father that cared, a father that, even though there were the shackles, he was present in heart, he was present in mind, he was there caring and concerned. And so, and that's the person. I don't have biological children of my own, but I care a lot about my nieces and nephews and my cousins and my whole family and my sisters, and they know that that's a part of who they know me to be, is a caring male. Mm. I think that's really important, that whether or not we're in shackles, whether or not we're behind bars, is that there's caring there. There is compassion there. There's more there than a person who is in captivity.
One of the songs in the performance, the song Escape,
mm.
really touched me because you mentioned things like they want to run away, but they can't because physically they're unable to run fast. And the words of the song,
wow.
If you want to talk about the lyrics of that song.
We come to the fight spot.
I love the kind of listener you are, and the way that you got it. Like, you know, we haven't talked about this prior to this interview, but yeah. So I wanted to talk about psychological and emotional escape, because once again, connected with the theme of like imprisonment, a lot of the great thinkers that experienced imprisonment, they talk about being able to have solitude within oneself, to be able to find freedom even when you're locked behind bars. I'm thinking about Reuben Hurricane Carter. I'm thinking about Dr. King. I'm thinking about Nelson Mandela. Right, I'm thinking about Stanley Tukey Williams. All of those are black men that were incarcerated. But in the story of Millie Christine, I know that had to be something incredible for them to say, okay, where is our freedom, and who are we, and how will we liberate ourselves emotionally and spiritually, psychologically? So that song, I think it effectively conveys that message, because people get it and people talk about it. Usually, you know, sometimes it's after, you know, it's after more conversations than the one that we had. But yeah.
A miniature surprise for you. Okay. My cohort and my co-producer of the show, Lee Hay, found this book.
Uh-huh.
From the library in Cincinnati. It's called Millie Christine, Fearfully and Wonderfully Made. Are you familiar with this book?
Yeah, I have that book, and I'm really pleased to see, I've been planning to put in a request to have this ordered so that they could have some copies in the Cincinnati library. But this looks like this one. I've used Search Ohio and Ohio Link on frequent, many occasions. So we have to get some that belonged to the Cincinnati Library installed there.
You made reference in one of the videos about the disparity between the written history and the oral history that are familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, and this is a wonderful phrase that I just love, you say, a lie in print is stronger than one on the lips.
Yeah, interesting. Some of the things that I've read, and some people that I talk to, like the journalist, for example, in North Carolina, he made reference to the people that own them teaching them how to sing. And that was like, and this is a guy that's well-meaning, because he's sharing their story all around North Carolina. At the time, he was a part of a historical society that was talking mainly about the relatives of the people there, and they, you know, mainly white North Carolinians that were talking about, you know, my uncle, he had a farm, and the stories weren't impressive to him, even as being, you know, probably at the time a 30 or 40 year old white man. He was like, well, you know, if we really want to do this work as a historical society, we should dig deeper, and I think we should start here. Who else has an obituary that was printed in the New York Times? And he was talking about Millie Christine. So I'm giving some character building there to say that this is a guy that means really well. But when he told this story about them being taught how to sing, it struck me as strange, because almost every African-American family, or even African family that I know of, singing is just a part of, it's like cooking and drinking and or sleeping, you know, music and singing. And so there is this whole idea of like, they had to be taught something. They had to be given, they had to be cultured, they had to be developed. And as I, when I read some of the things that I've read in different books, there is an overkinding, if I can invent a word. There's this idea that someone did them a favor. And so I'm working out that balance to figure out like, well, there was definitely a relationship between the people who owned them and themselves, because later in their life, they did employ those people as their managers. So I'm trying to find, there's the truth is often somewhere between what the official story is, what's told as history, and what the folklore is and the legend is. It's somewhere in there, and so I'm still hunting, searching for the truth.
The performance coming back to Cincinnati, Millie Christine, twice the first time, Friday, May 17th at the Woodward Theater.
Mm-hmm.
What sort of things do you have for the audience that night?
Wow, this one is going to be really special. We have, the show continues to be refined and developed and made more powerful. So people will see a really interactive film working, like the art of the visual film that we were talking about, ease manipulating. It's also a surprise of like incorporating more family, more of my current family that are alive now to help tell the story. And so I don't want to give away too much of it, but I think that people will really be captured by the way that we tell the story and what we've added to it. And we'll also have a special guest pianist. There's one song that is not an original composition of the players, and that song is a Abby Lincoln song. Abby Lincoln was a huge singer that I really, really love and appreciate for her poetry and her compositions, but she has a song called Who Used to Dance, and it fits well within this project, as if it were made for this project, in terms of its theme and its the way that the song just works. It's just a great song. The piano player that played with Abby Lincoln for years before she passed away, his name is Mark Carey, and he's going to join us. He's coming from New York to play with us on this show at the Woodward Theater, and so that's really exciting as well.
Wow. This sounds like just a beautiful story, well told, but the fact that it has such a family connection to you and to your history is just one more level of greatness. I'm really excited that you're bringing us back to town. Thank you for doing that, and thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Must outsmart the master.
Must outsmart the Millie Christine, Twice the First Time, comes to the Woodward Theater Friday, May 17th. For links to more information or to buy tickets, visit our website at wvxu.org/lx. Local Exposure is a production of Cincinnati Public Radio and 91.7 WVXU. This episode was recorded and produced by me, Jim Nolan, with research assistance by Lee Hay. The theme music for this show is by Scott Holmes and comes from the Free Music Archive. You can find out more at freemusicarchive.com. Until next time.